Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to The Drop at DFT. Today is a rare treat. You are getting a non-hosted episode of The Drop. Painful as it may be for me, I hand the reins over to our head of VFX, Dylan Shadinsky, and our senior lead VFX artist, Carlo Vega, both of whom are VFX supervisors here at Digital Film Tree, and they actually hosted a workshop at South by Southwest this year. It was called VFX Onset 101. They talked to a full room of people who were looking for guidance on their indie budget feature films, their TV projects, their giant features, and everything in between. They had a full room that they got to help take from conception through to final deliverable when dealing with the myriad of issues that come up either on set or when planning for on set. And so they were able to share between the two of them, about 40 years worth of VFX supervision wisdom that we have decided to also put into one of the drop episodes for you. So don't you worry, you will see us back here soon. I'm gonna do a recap of my own experience in the very next episode, but for now, I hand you over to Dylan and Carlo.
Welcome everybody, my name is Carlo Vega. I'm a senior lead visual effects artist and on-set VFX supervisor for Digital Film Tree, and I'm here with
Dylan Shadinsky. I'm the head of visual effects at Digital Film Tree, and I've been a VFX on-set supervisor for a little more than 20 years.
And we're gonna show you our visual effects on-set 101 presentation, and we're gonna start it off with the showreel.
Okay, now that we're all in the mood for some visual effects, we'll go over what this workshop is going to be about. Some of the key points we'll cover are some basic visual effects vocabulary and terminology. We'll talk about the role of the VFX supervisor from pre-production to production to post. We'll also cover some common pitfalls and mistakes that people might make on set, as well as get into some of the more advanced methods at the end of the presentation.
So we're going to start this off by differentiating special effects from visual effects. So special effects are done on set live in front of the camera. And this can be fire, this could be smoke effects, it could be makeup effects. And then visual effects is what is done using software and compositing. So this is where the visual effects artists will do their magic to make the shot right.
Okay, now that we've got that sorted out, we're going to go ahead and start with some of those basic vocabulary words so that when we use them later in the presentation, you guys know what we're talking about. And some of this terminology that we're going to go over will be plates, keying, rotoscoping, tracking, what an element is, CGI, and compositing. So what is a plate? A plate is basically your very basic puzzle pieces that you use to put together to make a visual effects shot. It's kind of the most common way to describe this would be a foreground plate and a background plate. So let's say you were shooting someone on a green screen and you want to cut them out of that and put them onto some stock footage that you're compositing them into. Basically, your person on the green screen would be your foreground plate and that stock footage would be the background plate.
And in this example here from Manifest, the people in the foreground, that is the foreground plate, and the people in the background where the subway goes by is the background plate. So for safety purposes, this is a split screen where we combined a foreground and a background plate.
And you could have multiple plates depending on what you're doing with the shot. Another kind of plate you might have is a clean plate. Clean plates are really useful if you need to remove something from a shot later. It's really good to have an empty frame where all the actors are out of frame. So you basically have a clean plate of the environment. Another reason you might have a clean plate is if you need to shoot a pickup shot later. So for instance, in this shrinking example, they had basically already struck the set. So they no longer had this kitchen set that they needed to shoot a pickup line in. Luckily, we did have this clean plate that they had shot for some other scene, and we were able to shoot Jason on a green screen and then key him and put him into the clean plate, and you see the result here.
And it's important to talk about the back plates before you go and shoot. Luckily, the lighting of the kitchen is matched with the lighting on our actor here, and it works really well. It's a great way to blend the shots together.
So it's always useful to have your back plate in mind before shooting the foreground plate. So keying, as I mentioned before, when you have someone on a green screen, you're gonna need to key them out. Basically, what that is doing is selecting one color in a shot and subtracting it from that shot. In this example here, you see a woman in front of a green screen. Basically, the computer can select the color green and remove it. And then you have that person with alpha channel or transparency, if you know what, like a PNG is, like an image file with transparency. That's really what you're going for here. You don't have to necessarily have a green screen. It could be a blue screen, any solid color that is the opposite of what the person in front of it is wearing or made up of. You can also use luminance to key as opposed to color. In this example here, what you're seeing is Jason on the green screen, and then the black and white image is the alpha channel, or what can be referred to as a matte. Basically, anything in a matte that is pure white is going to be opaque, and anything that is pure black is going to be fully transparent. If something is gray, it's going to be translucent, so it'll be a little see-through. And then you also see the result here, which is Jason basically with an alpha channel.
And I'll just add that the green screen in this shot here is very evenly lit, which makes it great for keying. If this weren't evenly lit, then getting that alpha channel is going to be difficult, and there'll be gradients in the key, and it just takes longer to really key everything out that needs to be out.
And we'll get more into that later.
Yeah.
Rotoscoping. So what rotoscoping is not what the old definition was in the old animation days where you're basically painting something by hand, frame by frame, but it is the process of cutting something out of a shot frame by frame. So what rotoscoping is, is what's needed when you shoot something without a green screen, but then you need to separate your subject from a background. So it's really tedious. You really have to get there almost frame by frame, by hand, cutting something out. It's particularly tricky when it comes to hair. It's almost impossible to properly rotoscope hair. So what a lot of people will do is actually add fake hair to an element to make that look real.
Yeah, there's methods now that have kind of sped up the process of rotoscoping. There's like Nuke's machine learning tools, and there's also Adobe After Effects' Roto Brush that is pretty good. But nothing beats a human person doing it by hand. And now tracking. So tracking is the act of emulating the camera move that was shot on set that day in the compositing software. And there's varying levels of tracking. There's one-point tracking, two-point tracking, planar tracking, 3D tracking. And there's varying levels of complexity with all this. And next is tracking markers. So a tracking marker is extra data that you put practically on set that day onto your phone or the TV to give the VFX artist more data to track the image. A lot of times we don't need tracking markers in the shot, so we're gonna touch on some times that we've been surprised at how many people put tracking markers all over something when it's not necessary.
Yeah, basically, if your environment has enough detail to provide points that you can use for tracking data, you really don't need extra markers. Mm. If you're shooting something on a green screen and there is a camera movement, though, that's when you're actually going to need a tracking marker. Normally, you don't need anything as fancy as this little thing you're seeing up here with all the triangles. A green tape in the form of an X will usually get the job done.
Yeah. And parallax. So parallax is something that results from 3D tracking a shot with a kind of a very long horizon line. And that's where the foreground movements and the background movements start to kind of sway with each other. So just be mindful that if you have a shot that is a tricky camera move and there's a lot of parallax and foreground and middle ground and background elements, just know that if you 3D track that, it's going to take a while to have things match up correctly. So if you're in doubt, just lock the camera.
Yeah, and you never want to try to put two shots together that have competing parallax in some sort of like split screen or something like that. It's really difficult, if not impossible, to do. And another thing that is important to talk about when tracking is that the camera move of your shot is really going to determine whether you can do the visual effect in all 2D or 2.5D, or if you actually have to do some sort of 3D composite or motion control. Because as you can see, if a camera starts moving too far around a flat image, it's going to start looking like a cardboard cutout at a certain point.
Yeah, so your shot is just a 2D card. Think of it like that. If you need to give it more depth, we can go in and add 3D objects and things like that to help it out, but it's an expensive route to go. We want to avoid that as much as possible. So next are elements. So elements are plates that you can buy usually online that are usually pre-keyed elements that are fire, smoke, wood chips falling, sand, even assets of people clapping or audience members, you know, cheering. So these are elements that you can buy online, and they're pre-keyed, and you can place them into your shot for compositing purposes. And a lot of times you can do this for safety reasons too. So say you can't have a fire in a small room or anything like that, but just know that you can purchase pre-packed elements that have this option.
I do also want to point out that this is a great example of a time where you can use luminance keying. You see this like white dust on a black background. You can actually use the brightness of the smoke to separate it from the background itself and get an alpha channel that way.
Yep. And of course, CGI. So CGI is computer-generated imagery. It's the flashy stuff of visual effects. I think it's what most people think about when they think of visual effects. But just know that it's an entire recreation of an image. And it usually involves very specialized teams of people that do this. And they specialize really well at doing that one thing, whether it's like texturing, lighting, rigging. We got some pyro effects, smoke effects. So it's very specialized and it's expensive. So it's important to know when you absolutely need this. And of course, compositing, which is the act of bringing this all together. So this is where the artist will bring in their elements, other plates, maybe elements rendered from 3D software, and put it all together and emulate the environment in which it was shot in.
All right, now that we kind of have a good vocabulary going in terms of visual effects, we can talk about what the actual job of a VFX supervisor is. The number one job is to take what the writer and what the director have in mind and figure out how to actually bring that to life within the budget that the producers have allotted. You know, a lot of times you can come up with clever ways to get something done for less money because of certain restrictions. But essentially what you are trying to do is bring the director's vision to life, but also you should be accountable to the artist as well and make sure that you have gotten all the pieces and plates needed so that their job is not only the easiest in the end, but also the most effective and will generate the most realistic looking image. So the first thing you want to do, ideally, as a VFX supervisor, is to get brought in from the very beginning. The very first thing you want to do is a script breakdown. Because a lot of times when you read a script, you'll, as a visual effects supervisor, notice a lot of things in there that maybe the production isn't thinking about as a visual effect and therefore not budgeting for. So you really want to give them all the possibilities so that they can make decisions ahead of time so that VFX aren't a surprise later on. For example, something like even having an iPhone in a shot, I would always call that out as a possible visual effect because they might not actually have what they need on the phone at the time. So that would have to be a comp later. So you would always want to possibly budget for that. And as you can see in this particular script, this is a movie about a bear. It's not a CG bear though, it is a practical bear. But some shots that were called out are some helicopter shots on a blue screen. Those are pretty obviously visual effects because, you know, there's two guys in a helicopter flying at night in a completely black sky. That's something that's probably not going to be very easy to shoot practically. So that's an easy thing to call out in the script. However, this shot of a real live bear walking around in the park is not actually called out. But because there is a bear on set, there are certain safety measures and training things that have to happen on set in order for the bear to get the performance that the production wants. So for instance, the bear might have a disc on the ground that is a mark that it needs to walk to. But if that disc is in the shot, it's gonna need painted out. Therefore, that's a visual effect and something that you should consider in your budget when you're breaking it down. Now that we've gone through that process and we have actually decided with production what is a potential visual effect, the first thing we need to start doing now is visualizing that effect. And the most classic way to do that is a storyboard. Most of you have probably seen storyboards before. Basically, it's just kind of like a comic book version of what is actually going to be shot on set.
And you don't need to be an artist, really, to do this. You can just start off this process just by having stick figures.
It helps, though. The next kind of level of a storyboard would be an animatic, which is actually a sequence cut together that could really help with timing and pacing if that's important to the visual effect. But essentially what an animatic is just like a mildly animated storyboard. And if you really have something complex that you need to block out, you might want to actually do real pre-visualization, which is kind of a rudimentary animation of an entire sequence where you really figure out blocking and camera movement. And it's really, really useful, especially in situations like this Umbrella Academy sequence we're seeing here that was very, very complex and had a lot of visual effects and action.
And in previs, you can really get technical details dialed in. Like you can change the camera, you can change the lens, and really figure out the look of how this is gonna go. But also, I want to say that previs has varying levels of preparation to it. This obviously is months in advance of preparation, but we've also done previs for shows literally just the night before. And we showed up to set with an iPad to show the director, and the director will see it and be like, okay, I like where this is going, I like the beats, but we're missing a close-up or we're missing like a wide shot. And so previs is also powerful just for that alone. And before we get to set, we got to prepare for visual effects. and let production know what they need on the day of shooting. So, do you need a green screen? You make sure you got to talk to production about this and make sure that they have what you need on production day. And that brings us to green screens and blue screens. So a blue screen is usually used if your shot is mainly going to be outside.
Or if your subject is wearing green.
Or if your subject is wearing green, right. Because the sky casts a kind of like a hint of blue on everything. So it's really helpful to use a blue screen. It matches the environment for outdoor scenarios a lot better. And then green screens are used if your character is wearing blue. And we have digi and chroma green. So chroma green is a kind of like a flatter shade of green, and it has less spill that it emits onto your actor.
Yeah, so if you're not able to get enough distance between your actor and your screen, you're probably going to want to use a chroma screen so that there isn't a lot of bounce.
Yep.
And but that's what spill basically is, when the light bouncing off the screen is contaminating the subject in front of it.
And then to remove that is could be a lengthy process for the VFX artist to do a separate key just to key that out. And then we have DigiGreen, which is reserved for large sound stages where you're shooting in a large environment and your actors are very far away from the screen, because it does have a lot of spill that it puts onto your actors, but it keys very easily. And a switcher. So a switcher is a service that's provided by the DIT. And so just know that when you're on set and you have a switcher and you're shooting a lot of plates with green screens or blue screens in them, a switcher can align them all up and do a live key for you right there on set with your back plate. So it's important to have a switcher there so you can make those judgment calls right there on set that day and you don't have any expensive mistakes in post.
Yeah, and DIT is basically a video playback operator. Mm-hmm. So anytime somebody shoots something on set, they can basically bring it up right away and replay it.
And of course, always talk to wardrobe. Make sure they're not wearing green in front, your actor is not wearing green in front of a green screen or blue in front of a blue screen. This happens all the time. Yeah. more often than it should. And also, you may need to talk to the stunt team and make sure that the rig removals are in the easiest place for visual effects to paint out. So in this famous example from The Matrix, they put the rigs around their belt line. And that's a really good place to put them, because if they put it around a harness and the wire goes in front of their faces, then it's going to cost a lot more just to paint out that wire in visual effects. So, and it also could be a scenario where you don't need wires at all.
Yeah, there was actually one shot that I had to work on at one point where there was someone on a hovercraft of some sorts flying outside of a window, and I wasn't actually brought in ahead of time on this one, and when I got the footage, they actually did pull this person up three stories on about 16 different wires that were holding him up in the air. He had to actually turn around, so all the wires were crossing in front of his performance. It was quite a nightmare to actually remove all those cables. His entire body basically needed recreated, including his face. A much simpler approach would have been to just shoot him in front of a green screen, maybe on some sort of turntable that they could, you know, turn around, and then I could have keyed him out and just put him outside the window and add a little float to him instead of the days and days of wire removal.
And I remember when I was called to set to supervise this nighttime green screen shoot, and I was really surprised to discover that production had purchased rented for the day this enormous green screen. And we didn't have a lot of time to talk about this beforehand. I just had to show up and supervise it. But the result was, with this massive green screen, that we needed to spend 2 hours placing flags to block out the reflections of the green onto the car. If I wasn't there and they had shot this with all the green spilling onto the car, then it would have been very difficult for the VFX artist to paint that all out. That's why communication is really crucial, so we can communicate about what the needs are on the day of shooting, because I would have just said, hey, we just need like a 10 by 10 foot kind of pop-up green screen here. We don't need this giant thing, but they rented it and they were gonna use it. And then here's another time when I was called in at the last minute to supervise this rooftop sequence of two actors talking to each other. And when I got to set, I was surprised to see that they were actually on top of the roof of a house, and they needed the house for other things, for other takes. So I would have said, hey, can we build a separate portion of the roof and just put that on the ground? And then that way our actors didn't have to be tethered because we had to paint that out, and we didn't have to have these enormous blue screens that kind of became kites and blew in the wind, and it was really kind of stressful. So ideally, you talk about these things earlier on because there's usually a very simple way to shoot what you need correctly.
Also, there's times when production isn't able to get the kind of screen you need. Like for example, this example from Scrubs, where a character, Turk, who always wears green scrubs, had to fly through the air, and we were gonna shoot him in front of a screen and a harness floating up in the sky. Unfortunately, there wasn't a blue screen available, so they actually had to use a green screen, and he wears green clothes, and as you saw from the example earlier with the meteorologist, that is not gonna work in front of a green screen. Luckily, Donald, who's the actor who played Turk, was the same size as his co-star, who always wears blue scrubs. So I just had him switch into those, shot him in the blue outfit in front of the green screen, and then I was able to key it out really well, and then just change the color of his blue scrubs to green in post, which is an actual very simple procedure.
Yeah, so that's a great example where you actually have two keying processes happening here.
And another thing that we should definitely reiterate whenever we talk about green screens is that green is not some magic color that you use every time there's a visual effect. All that keying is good for is a subtractive operation. So just painting something green is not gonna magically turn someone's arm from a human arm to a robot arm. And in fact, it could actually get in the way of the visual effect, especially if what you're doing is just adding something.
Yeah.
So if you're just covering up an arm, it would be much better to put some sort of tracking markers on the arm as opposed to just blanket making it green.
And in this example, they needed, they put a green box on the ground so the stunt person could use it to jump on top of the car. And then the cop got directly behind the box, and now they've obstructed his foot. So we had to have one of our talented visual effects artists go in there and animate the foot back inside. So
was that you?
No, it was Michael. and like we said, keying is a subtractive process. So your camera's on an X-ray machine. It can't magically see what's behind the green. And here's some really good examples of that. So you mentioned with the arm, making an arm green because we know it's going to be replaced. It doesn't need to be green. It's a reference for the artist to know where it's going to begin, where the effect is going to start. But you probably should just use a couple tracking markers, a couple little dots on the arm, because we've had scenarios where in continuity things change, and all of a sudden that robot arm needs to be a human arm. And that's a whole other can of worms. And what you've done by putting a green sleeve on is that you've now made the process a lot more complicated and a lot more expensive.
I do think sometimes, though, that making something green on set just makes everybody feel better when they're doing a visual effect.
Yeah, absolutely. And in this example on the left here, make sure there's a lot of communication before you shoot something on this level, because there's green objects going in front of actors, and the shot is going to have to live that way. It'd be a very costly process to have to paint those out.
All right, now that we've talked about what the role of visual effects supervisor is, let's talk about what happens on the day when you actually show up to set. First thing you're gonna wanna do when you get to set is find your AD or your assistant director. That is generally your conduit to everybody else that you're gonna need to get in contact with while you're on set. If it's a smaller production, you might just talk directly to the director, but on any sort of bigger project, you definitely wanna get to know the AD. You want to be there at the beginning of the day, even if your shot is later in the day, because they might be setting up the set for your shot earlier, and you really want to be there to prevent any issues at that point, and possibly, you know, decide where a tracking marker is going to go. You also want to be there to answer any questions that might come up. You are a security blanket when you're there, so you do want to make yourself available to anyone who might have questions. You also want to be there for rehearsals and when they're blocking the shots, because they might, you know, change where an actor is going to stand or where a performance is going to be. And if you're there during that, you can recognize that, okay, now they're blocking this tracking marker. I'm going to move it over here so it's in a better place.
I remember I was on set once and it was a 12-hour day and we're probably midway through it. And I remember they brought the actor out onto the green screen and the actor had a green mohawk on the green screen. And they were just going to start shooting it that way. So you want to make yourself available to prevent these hiccups that would be costly things to fix in visual effects. And next we're going to go into the most common VFX scenarios that we've encountered thousands of times in our careers. So screen comps. A screen comp is a burn-in or any kind of screen replacement. And we usually see people use just too many tracking markers. If you can see the shot and the shot, there's enough luminance in your shot to track it, and you can see the phone through the lens of the camera and it's visible, you don't need tracking markers.
Yeah, as long as you can see three of the corners, you're pretty much always going to be able to get a decent track.
And the result is, for something like the iPhone on the left there, is we're going to have to paint out all of those tracking markers. And now what we've done is that we've actually messed with the integrity of the shot, because we like to use transfer modes and bring back reflections. And now we can't do that. Another option, or another issue we see a lot, are people leaving any kind of screen just green or blue, or just leaving it on or putting tracking markers on it. Honestly, just turn it off. If no one's walking in front of it, just turn it off. And there's likely going to be enough data there for the artist to be able to track the shot if it's not completely dark.
Yeah, and plus, if you leave the television off, you're going to be able to get some nice reflections and really make the shot look actually realistic versus if it's on and you have no information to draw a reflection from.
Yeah, I think tracking markers are definitely the most overused thing that we've seen.
Tracking markers and making something green for no reason.
Yep. And here's some basic green screen mistakes that we've encountered. So the image on the left here, the actor may be lit correctly to match the back plate, which is good, but now the green screen is clearly had been sitting in a closet for a long time and is lit unevenly, and there's probably a shadow also being cast onto it. So you want to avoid that. You want a very evenly lit green screen or blue screen.
He's also way too close to it.
He's way too close to it. That looks like digi-green too.
And nobody told him to put his collar down.
Yes. And that is why we're here, Dylan. Visual effects and fashion. The image on the right is an expensive mistake that someone made where they just used too many tracking markers. Honestly, we may need like two or three tops, and we'd probably put them above his head. By putting too many tracking markers here, once you key out that green, we're just going to be left with the tracking markers. And that just is going to take a long time and a lot more rotoscope work in the end.
And while we're on the subject of green screens, I do want to bring up that if you do have a blonde subject, you might actually want to do a blue screen because the blonde hair is really going to suck up the green spill and be difficult to key.
Wait, is it like the color wheel? It's like if you have a blue screen, whatever is opposite of the color wheel should be like the clothes that you should...
Yeah. So in an ideal world, your screen is basically the opposite color of whatever you're putting in front of it. So
yeah.
If you really wanted to key something yellow, you would use a purple screen. But
yeah.
You know, obviously.
There are red screens too. Okay, so next are paintouts. So paintouts are unforeseen circumstances that happen when you're shooting. And it could be a wire, it could be a production, you know, PA that walked onto set. We had a mailman walk onto the set once. These things never go right when you go and shoot that day. And scenarios like these are very situational. So if the boom mic is entering the shot and it's against a blank wall, you know that it's going to be a lot easier just to pan out that boom mic. If the boom mic goes over a crowd of people cheering and clapping, it's going to take a lot more time and a lot more money to paint out the boom mic in front of people clapping and cheering. So it's best just to get another take in that scenario.
Yeah, so this isn't necessarily something that as a visual effects supervisor you're going to plan for, but it is something that you can help the production out with while you're there on set. You know, if you notice something that's going to be problematic, or, you know, if it would take them an hour to figure out how to shoot a shot to get this boom mic out, you can just tell them it's only going to take 5 or 10 minutes to remove in visual effects, so don't worry about it.
And next is distortion mapping. So distortion mapping is the act of having a checkerboard or a poster board with a grid on it and you put it right in front of the camera before they start shooting. And what this will do is that we can use that data to emulate the lens distortion on top of the visual effects being done by the artist. Some lenses introduce more distortion than others, and a lot of times it's helpful data to have for a visual effects artist because it can really take the shot the extra 10% that honestly I feel like takes the most amount of time to do.
Yeah, and this is just one example of the kind of data that as a visual effects supervisor you're expected to get on set that you can then provide the artist with later to make their job easier and more effective. Mm-hmm. Other examples might be, you know, distance to the camera, the lighting setup, or
HDRI photography. So HDRI photography is the act of putting your DSLR camera that you bring onto set. A lot of visual effects supervisors do this, and you start taking photographs, and you set the camera to HDRI mode, and what it will do is take many stops of the same image. So then what happens is that you can go into Lightroom or Photoshop. There's a lot of softwares that do this now, and they will compile all of the images to make one very high bandwidth image. And you can use that as a backplate for things. You can use it as a reference. You could also shoot for CG. You can also shoot an HDRI image onto a Chrome ball. And a CG artist can use this in 3D to help with global illumination and as a reference for where lighting is hitting the image. So we would basically take a HDRI image of that Chrome ball with a DSLR camera, and then we can unwrap it and use that as a backplate or use it as a lighting reference for the CG artist. It's a very useful thing to have. You could also use the pano on your phone. We've done that too. And we also have the matte ball. So the matte ball is great for lighting data. So the 3D artist will know how the light is hitting the 3D geometry that they're introducing into the shot and how it tapers off. So that's also a very helpful reference to have on set that day. And we also got our color palette. So the color palette is very useful to have on set before you start shooting, after you get your lens distortion. So the color palette is great because depending on where you're shooting, whether you're shooting during magic hour or you're shooting in a dark closet or something, the colors are going to change. Your red and blues are going to be different. And so having this as a reference will give the visual effects artist data for their compositing. And depending on what it is, if it's very CG heavy stuff, this kind of data is crucial.
Yeah, for example, if Captain America's outfit is a particular Pantone of blue, that Pantone of blue is going to look different if he's in some sort of red lighting. So this is really good reference to have.
Yep. And the more advanced stuff.
One of the more common advanced tools that a visual effects supervisor might have is a motion control camera. And motion control is really great if you're, one, trying to capture a performance and a backplate at different times require a three-dimensional camera move. It's definitely something that you never want to try to just wing and recreate a move on your own. It's never going to work well. But what motion control does is actually saves the camera move as data and can recreate it as many times as you need. In the example we're watching now from Umbrella Academy, it's actually panning around this spaceship, but it's supposed to be different days. So like each time the camera moves, it reveals the same actor in a different place doing a different thing. So obviously that actor's not just running around the camera and then getting into position. It's actually recreating this move several times, and he's giving several performances in different places on the set. That we then cobble together in post. A lot of times it's not exactly perfect. There might be a little shift in lighting or something on set might get bumped or something, and that'll need cleaned up. But for the most part, motion control is a great way to achieve something like multiple performances from one actor.
And motion control, it's not used that often. I wish it was used more often. It's an expensive tool to have on production day, but it's very powerful because the result is now the visual effects artist, all he or she has to do is mask in the plates where the actor is doing their performances instead of having to do paint and a lot of, you know, fake kind of camera moves. So you save a lot of time with this tool. And now we're going to talk about LED screens. So LED screens became popular from The Mandalorian because Mando's suit is is metallic and it has a lot of reflections on it. And it would have taken a lot of time for the visual effects artist to paint out or paint in those reflections if they shot him on a green or blue screen. So just know with LED screens, it's expensive, it's an exact science, and you want to work with the engineers that have created this, because the camera is synced up to a game engine, which is moving with the environment and changing. So we've been called into scenarios where, unfortunately, it didn't work out and the background was not synced to the camera. And then the result was a lot of expensive rotoscope work.
Yeah, and one of the big advantages of LED besides reflections is because, you know, you're actually having that image live on set, it's also providing reactive lighting on people and stuff
yes,
like that.
Yes, absolutely.
But like Carlo alluded to, when it does go wrong, here comes rotoscoping. Yep. And you have to completely cut everybody out.
And then, of course, virtual production. So virtual production is the act of having your camera synced up to be able to do a live key and be able to track the environment as the camera moves around. So then we can put in an environment and it's tracked back in correctly, or we can put in 3D objects behind the actors and it will be tracked back in and look like it's part of the environment. It's definitely a cheaper option compared to shooting on an LED screen.
Yeah, so you basically get the advantage of being able to line stuff up and the advantage of having a lot of agility later if you need to replace the background, but you're just not getting that reactive lighting.
Yeah, and these cameras shoot in passes. So worst case scenario, if things don't work out, you always have your actors on a green screen to composite.
Okay, so that is basically what a VFX supervisor does. That's some of the terms that a VFX supervisor uses, some of the tools they utilize on set, as well as, you know, some kind of tips and tricks to make your effects easier in the long run and really get, you know, a efficient and realistic product within the type of budget that you're working in.
And we just want to reiterate that it's all about communication. It's starting that line of communication early with your producers and your directors and making sure that you have what you need the day you go and shoot so things don't become more expensive for you in the end.
Yeah, you definitely want to be involved from the beginning and every step of the way.
Yes.
And now,
in a vacuum.
Any questions?
Yeah.